What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Ben Jackson. My guest today is a senior lecturer in international relations at the Coral Bell School of Asia and the Pacific at Australian National University. He's very active in the Australian foreign policy conversation, and he's published a slew of journal articles on nukes, strategic stability, weapons trends, polarity, you know, English school IR, great power shit, even progressive foreign policy from an Australian standpoint, which is doubly interesting. My guest is, of course, Dr. Benjamin Zala. Welcome to the show, brother. How you doing?
Hey, man. Thanks very much. Nice to be on a show that I'm already a card-carrying fan of and a regular listener.
New friend of the pod. All right. So we're doing this episode to talk about what you and a couple other scholars have started characterizing as like a third nuclear age. And when we talk about ages from the perspective of like weapons, there's a way in which we're talking about a kind of change of terrain, like a shift in the conventional wisdom about incentives and risks of strategy and military choices. But just because it's like the conventional wisdom doesn't mean that it's like true or correct. So in a way, we're looking at how strategists are extrapolating from global trends and such. But, you know, the reason why it ends up mattering in the real world, it's like, well, if you believe this stuff, even if it's not true, it's going to affect the choices of states and militaries and all that. It's great to have you here because in the early episodes of the podcast, we used to do this kind of topic a lot more. But A, my audience has kind of shifted over time. And then B, I became mindful that this kind of conversation gets very jargony and esoteric, like very quickly. So as we go through the discussion today, I may pause us, you know, here and there to clarify terms and things for people listening, watching. So on the one hand, we're having our own discussion, me and you. On the other hand, in order for people to be a fly on the wall and understand what's going on, we may have to like break the fourth wall every so often.
Please do. It's one of my pet hates in this area, that the jargons, the acronyms, because it becomes esoteric, right? It's a great way of locking people out of a conversation to be SLBM this and MRV that and whatever. And people are sitting thinking, I don't know what you're talking about. And there's no need to do it, but we use them as shorthand, right? Because you're in this world all the time, you get sick of saying intercontinental ballistic missile in every sentence, right? Yes. So whenever I let my guard down and drop one of those annoying acronyms, pull me up and ask me what it means.
Yeah, I'll try. So I do it too. So we'll monitor each other.
We'll be all right.
All right. So you have what I think is like a fairly groundbreaking article in the European Journal of International Security with Andrew Futter, and it's called Strategic Non-Nuclear Weapons and the Onset of a Third Nuclear Age. So obviously, if there's a third nuclear age, potentially, then there were prior nuclear ages. So to start off, can you give us like a snapshot of what the first nuclear age was, how it was characterized, what time period it covered, all that?
Yeah, sure. And I think you're absolutely right to start by sort of, you know, to use the trendy phrase, problematizing a bit the idea of nuclear ages. And it's a really odd thing. And this is coming from a co-author of an article about a nuclear age, right? Like, are you mad? So
you're self-conscious of it, though, which is good.
Right. It's something that Drew and I really struggled with, because as you've alluded to, the central argument of the piece is thinking in terms of a second nuclear age, deciding that we lived in a second nuclear age and it's all changed now and so forth, has produced a whole set of trends that we're arguing is actually creating a third nuclear age. Mm-hmm. So the first thing to say is, periodization of all kinds of history is tricky, imperfect, strange. It's a strange world to enter into. And that's periodization of all kinds, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages or however it is that you're trying to break up, you know, early modern, pre-modern, late modern. These are all different ways of trying to make sense of and compartmentalize a big, long, messy history. Yeah. And so with the nuclear age that obviously starts in 1945, it was some time into the period that they define as the second nuclear age, but sort of in the mid to late 90s, a whole bunch of scholars started referring to the post-Cold War era as the second nuclear age. So that basically tells us that in their minds, the first nuclear age pretty much lines up with the Cold War. it's basically 45, and then you got that tricky thing. I'm pretty sure from memory in the article, we kind of sort of swiveled around, oh, where do you want to put the end date of the Cold War? Is it the Berlin Wall coming down 89? Is it the formal dissolving of the Union in 91? Yeah. You know, whatever. But it's basically the first nuclear age is the Cold War period. And it's therefore associated with the two major nuclear armed actors. So it's really associated very much with the nuclear policies of the US and the Soviet mm-hmm. Union. And it's associated with arms racing between the two, you know, the, with capital T, nuclear arms race, associated with the development of nuclear doctrine. Mm-hmm. Remember, nuclear doctrine didn't exist because nuclear weapons didn't exist. We hadn't had to think about them before. And particularly associated with a particular doctrine that became known as mutual assured destruction. So the idea that if we are to find stability in a nuclear armed world, short of getting rid of those nuclear weapons, then the way that they're postured should be towards deterrence rather than war mm-hmm. fighting. And the most stable way of doing that is having both sides trying to deter each other, and therefore both sides be mutually vulnerable to each other. It's a kind of a pessimistic outlook that says the only reason I'm not destroying Van Jackson is because I'm concerned about the possibility of Van Jackson not being able to destroy it all in one go, and Van being able to respond in kind and destroy me. So that's why it's mutual assured mm-hmm. destruction, right? So these ideas, arms racing, even the space race, so very much on kind of what we call vertical proliferation, as in growing the stockpiles of states who already have nuclear mm-hmm. weapons, more than horizontal proliferation, the spread to new states. These are all the things we associate with the first nuclear age. And often the phrase, it's very old fashioned now, people don't say it, which tells us something about how these things change, the idea of the central balance.
Yeah.
That the balance, the nuclear balance between these two actors, the Soviet Union and the United States, is the most important thing that we need to worry about. And, you know, we'll care about nuclear armed alliances like NATO, we'll care about new actors like Britain and then France and then China, and we'll even care enough to negotiate a big treaty to kind of stop that spread. You get the NPT during the first nuclear age, right? NPT being the Nuclear Non-Proliferation
Thank
Treaty.
You. That was good. So, yeah, I didn't have to pause you, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, it's not that the things that we started to care more about in the so-called second nuclear age, in the kind of post-Cold War era, were absent, just that they were took a back seat to these other concerns, which was basically the averting the prospect of nuclear war between the two superpowers. That was the number one thing on the kind of the desks of decision makers in capitals that mattered during the first nuclear age.
Yeah. So, okay. First nuclear age, Cold War, nukes are super rare, super hard to get. Classical arms racing is a major strategic concern. The value of nukes in that setting, or as far as like the US and the Soviets are concerned, is really to bolster mutually assured destruction, or like, and for other states, mutual vulnerability, I guess. This first nuclear age also gave birth to the nuclear revolution, which you sort of like hinted at there. This is an important concept. It's still prominent, but now that it's like, it's more controversial. And
that's right.
I guess to start, like, how do you define the nuclear revolution? And then maybe we can talk about it a little bit.
Yeah. It's a really good point. And there's some really interesting work that's come out in the last few years that I characterize as a kind of revisionist take on the nuclear revolution. Because they're basically saying, actually, do you know what? During the first nuclear age, the revolution was not quite as widespread and internalized as we like to tell ourselves that it was. If you go back and look at policies, people were trying to escape the nuclear revolution all the time.
Yeah.
I actually don't agree with all of
I was going to say, I don't agree with it either entirely.
No, I think it over-eggs the pudding in various ways. I just don't think you can explain something like the anti-ballistic missile treaty, right? Where both sides agree to limit their ability to defend themselves because they reluctantly, of course, recognize that each side has to remain roughly as vulnerable as the other, or it's going to be a very unstable system. But so the idea of the nuclear revolution is it was a revolution in thinking about warfare, right? And there's a whole bunch of lovely quotes that illustrate this. People, you know, in 1945, 1946, 1947, trying to get their heads around this, that all boil down to kind of variations on the theme, which is to basically say, in the past, the role of our armed forces was to fight wars and win wars. And now their role is to avoid fighting the war in the first place because the war would be so destructive that there'd be nothing left to fight for, right? And that is a revolutionary way of thinking about warfare at that point in history. You didn't have generals sitting around working out, how do we not start a war here? That was for political types, right? The role of the general is to come in and tell you how, if we're in this war, this is how we're going to win it, right? And it's not that they completely stopped doing that. So no one's arguing that, you know, any of the Cold War conflicts, right? That either side in the Korean War were not trying to win. Of course they were, but they were limited in what they did because they didn't want to start a nuclear war, right? There's a reason why the US in, you know, in between 1950 and 1953 during the Korean War opted not to go for that nice tool in the toolbox that it's only had for 5 years now that worked really well at the end of the last war, right? And there were members of the US Armed Forces, very high up, members of the US Senate and so forth, all saying, we're putting all this money into this super weapon. We've built it. Why aren't we using it? Why are we sending our young kids off to war to probably die in that war and not using a weapon that can bring that war to an end, right? So it was a change in the way we thought about how war works in world politics, what the military is for, and particularly what this sort type of weaponry is for, and the idea that it would become used for deterrent purpose only, that the use of a nuclear weapon is to threaten someone else to not use their nuclear weapon rather than, I mean, weapons are there to be used in warfare, right? They're there to help you win. This was a very different way of thinking about weapons. Should also say that, so some of this revisionist history is basically saying, yeah, but it's not like that was complete and total across all aspects of military thinking on, say, both sides of that Cold War divide. There were still people arguing for nuclear victory, and there were still policies aimed at achieving victory against a nuclear-armed power. Yeah. We didn't fully accept vulnerability. You know, scholars will say we did track and then tail Soviet nuclear-armed submarines rather than seeing where they were and saying, do you know what, let them go, because they need to have those survivable second strike capabilities, right, to be able to retaliate. They went, no, we want to know exactly where they are, because if this all kicks off, we're going to sink those submarines, right? So it's not that it was this kind of total revolution and everyone said, yep, got it, cool, we're never going to have a major power war ever again. Both sides prepared and spent money hand over fist to try and give themselves the best chance of winning a major power war during this period. But it did change the way that states acted. It forced them into some degree of restraint that I think you just can't explain otherwise without that kind of revolution in thinking.
Yeah. The logic of mutually assured destruction, the logic that you cannot win a nuclear war in the traditional sense, that obviously seems to hold, and it has some explanatory power. I guess the thing that, like, the nuclear revolution thesis doesn't fully account for is, like, well, why are they arms racing if they accept right? Like, there's no point.
And I think there's actually a relatively, and I say relatively, in practice it's complex and nuanced and difficult to pinpoint whatever, but there's a relatively simple causal explanation, which is to say, okay, so if you were going to accept MAD, you're kind of accepting that there is an upper limit to all of this, that there is a, you know, that we basically know what parity, so as in matching each other weapon for weapon, looks like. In practice, it's much, much harder than that. I mean, think of the, there was a famous episode in US domestic politics as President Kennedy was coming to power that's referred to as the kind of missile gap episode, right, where sort of elements of the US political machine were convincing themselves that there's a missile gap between us and the Soviets. The Soviets are ahead of us. Then it actually turned out that that was just not even close to being the case. It just was wildly inaccurate. Yet one side convinced itself that it had to develop all these missiles because we're falling behind. Well, what's the other side going to do? They sit there and go, look at them. They've made this excuse. They're saying they're falling behind, but they know they're not. Come on, guys. And what they're trying to do is get one up on us. So we'll have to return in kind. So basically you explain the nuclear revolution coexisting with arms racing because the security dilemma, which is a phrase we might have to explain.
I was going to say quite a dilemma.
It doesn't disappear, right? Yeah. So the security dilemma in basic terms is that the things that I do quite genuinely to defend myself So, and it has to be genuinely defensive intent. People often get this wrong. Mm-hmm. If I have offensive intent, well, it's not the security dilemma. We're just talking about something else, right? Yep. But the things that I do to genuinely defend myself, make myself more secure, and I wish you no harm. I'm just worried about you or others or whatever it is, right? I'm just trying to defend myself, can have a dual use, can also be used to threaten you. And so you face no choice there, really. Well, you do actually face a choice, and that's where the security dilemma comes in. But you are being incentivized to respond in kind. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, my worst fears are confirmed. Oh, I knew you had hostile intent. Well, I better secure. And that's how we end up in spiraling and arms racing. And this is stuff that IR theorists have looked at for decades now. And the really sad part about it is it doesn't disappear.
Yeah.
It doesn't just go away because you've decided to think otherwise, right? You still send signals, and the only actor that gets to decide how that signal is received is the actor themselves. It doesn't matter what you say or what you try to do or whatever. If they decide you have hostile intent, or that you might in the future, even if I do trust you now, I can't trust your successor in the future. This is what drives arms racing, and we still see that today.
Yeah, and the more you try to rationally optimize your military security, the more it's going to feed the dilemma, which is part of the dilemma. This episode is going to be a great resource for my security studies course. I'm going to assign.
Glad to oblige. But it's interesting to kind of circle back and link this together so that we're not, you know, going off on rambling tangents and chatting about the complexities of the security dilemma. This all matters for the first nuclear age, right? Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that the first nuclear age ends up over time, and this is really important to understand too, right? This doesn't happen in 1945. The revolution thinking doesn't happen and everyone goes, okay, great. We don't need to engage in any of these dangerous practices. Stability is the goal. Excellent. Far from it, right? We get the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
Because it takes quite a while. We get two Berlin crises. It takes quite a while to figure out how you do this, how you live in this extremely dangerous world with this new form of weaponry that is just unlike anything else we've ever had before. And so over time, what develops in the Cold War is a sense that all this stuff really matters, and a kind of an understanding at the policy level, never articulated using the phrase the security dilemma, right? That's for us fusty old academics in our ivory tower. But the concept of the security dilemma becomes part of international political life. And you see states like the Soviet Union and the US engaging in arms control agreements and so forth to restrain themselves voluntarily, but making sure that they're both doing it, out of a recognition that the security dilemma is real, that we can't just keep pushing each other into this arms race. We've got to put the brakes on somewhere. And that involves recognizing a bit that my actions can seem threatening to others.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a reflexive property or principle when awareness about a security dilemma, whether you're using the phrase or not, actually induces a kind of restraint that it influences policy in a way that encourages stability.
And speaking of over-egging the pudding, we should say, like, this didn't come easily. It wasn't there all the time. It was kind of rare, actually.
Yeah.
But we should also give due credit to two British scholars, Nick Wheeler and Ken Booth, who coined a really nice phrase for exactly what we're talking about.
Security dilemma sensibility,
yeah. Right? It is actually possible for leaders to get it, and you know, they might not even need to read academic articles to do so. But they can understand that their own actions can have unintended consequences and act accordingly. And you mm-hmm. kind of call that a sensibility to the idea of the security dilemma.
Yeah, totally. Good reference too. Okay, so how do you describe the second nuclear age then, and what made it different from the first?
So the second nuclear age comes about by decision makers and analysts and pundits and so forth deciding that everything has changed, looking at the world and saying, well, the Cold War's over. The Soviet Union doesn't even exist anymore post the end of 91, you know, and the Russian Federation that has replaced it seems to be relatively weak. And early on in that stage may even be sort of coming over our side of the ledger in terms of kind of broad ideological persuasion and so forth. And there was lots of, I think, very misplaced optimism about all of that, right? But where concerns about nuclear weapons therefore shifted to was away from this idea of the central balance and mm-hmm. stability between the two major nuclear armed powers, who we should note still accounted for and still today account for about 90% of nuclear warheads in stockpiles around the world. So this weird thing happens where we decide the world's changed and threats are different and so forth. But in material terms, these two states, so the now Russian Federation and the United States, in terms of nuclear numbers, stand head and shoulders above all the rest. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, you know, again, to use a really a geeky IR term that we might come to later on, it's a kind of a bipolar, you know, bipolarity ended, right? Because one of the poles, which was the Soviet Union, fell apart. There was only one pole left, so we enter the unipolar moment. But in nuclear terms, it remained extremely bipolar. You know, those two are the two that count, and then there's a bunch of others. But because of the lack of political confrontation, strategic confrontation, there was this sense that nuclear dangers are elsewhere. And this was very much driven by both policy and discussion in the United States and then US allies. And so then you might say the West more broadly. They started talking about this as a second nuclear age where things are different enough that we should think of it as sort of qualitatively different in this periodization terms, right? Mm-hmm. And the key kind of hallmarks of this is not arms racing between the superpowers and the central balance and mutually assured destruction and all the rest, all the stuff we'd become used to. That was now a very old hat. Now the things we needed to worry about is so-called rogue states, which we know this is a Western-led idea because that's a Western concept, right?
Mostly North Korea, but yeah.
I mean, we'll tell you who the rogues are, and it's certainly not us as we blatantly break the UN Charter.
Not us, yeah.
Any of that, right? We will name the rogues. We'll even sometimes put them in a list for you. It's very helpful. we'll give it a nice title like the Axis of Evil or whatever.
Axis. Outpost. Yeah.
But that's where nuclear threats emanate from. It's a return to worrying about proliferation, horizontal proliferation, so the spread to new states.
Spread.
So, of course, a lot of the concern comes about in the aftermath of the first Gulf War in 1991, where the whole sort of non-proliferation regime that's been built up and seemed to be working unbelievably well, that, you know, only a tiny minority of states have decided to opt to get themselves the most destructive weapon in human history, and the vast majority have sort of done what might seem illogical and said, no, we're good. We're not going to build these. And that's basically, in my view, it's down to kind of a mutual distrust, right? We're not building them, not because we're good guys, but we don't want our neighbors having them. And so if we all do this together, that's a safer world for us. Well, you might say that's also some, it requires some form of trust as well, but it's a sort of a mix of trust and distrust. And so in the aftermath of the first Gulf War, when US forces are in there and they get weapons inspectors in there, they find out that actually Iraq, who on paper had been a member in good standing of the non-proliferation regime, had been cheating and had been cheating for some time and had gotten a very long way towards building a nuclear weapons program. That had they not done the really dumb thing and invaded Kuwait and had all this.
This is Iraq of the 90s, by the way, 80s and 90s, not
80s, 90s Iraq, not
2003 Iraq.
Now, this comes back around in 2003, right, where the allegation remained and they didn't, because actually the weapons inspectors had gotten rid of everything and Iraq was bluffing and they actually didn't have the weapons that they wouldn't confirm that they definitely didn't have, right? They kept giving inspectors a run around to just try and hedge their bets a little bit, whilst also saying what ended up to be true, that they didn't have those weapons anymore. Mm-hmm. So the concern, a lot of the sort of second nuclear age stuff is this genuine psychological shock that, wow, the non-proliferation regime isn't quite as foolproof as we thought. There's big gaping holes in it. Mm-hmm. And states can cheat and they can have clandestine programs. So it becomes a concern about horizontal proliferation, also a concern about nuclear terrorism, non-state actors. You know, if you're not going to worry about superpowers, because there aren't these two superpowers that exist anymore, we've got to worry about something else. What about non-state actors? That's always been a threat since the nuclear age began. There's always been non-state actors who might want them. And so all the panic became about, you know, nuclear terrorism and so forth. A concern about nuclear security more broadly, the securing of nuclear materials. Mm-hmm. A lot of this comes about, again, in the aftermath of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And there's this concern about so-called loose nukes, that you had this massive nuclear stockpile in a superpower. The superpower quite literally dissolves and turns into a bunch of new independent countries. And the and also the Russian economy falls through the toilet, to put it, you know, diplomatically. And so the concern is, who's looking after that massive nuclear stockpile that didn't dissolve when the Union did, right? Mm-hmm. And you have a much more collaborative, open relationship conducive to cooperation between the US and the now Russian Federation on these matters. Right? Mm-hmm. And with all this goes a change in thinking. And people start saying, you know what, we don't need to think about the central balance. We don't need to think about sort of superpowers or great powers. We don't need to really think about the kind of the great power politics of nuclear weapons. That's all very old fashioned. That's an outdated way of thinking about this. That's how we had to do it in the Cold War. That was the first nuclear age. Really, we're in a new nuclear age now. We're in a second nuclear age, and we can think differently. And the really big thing that this creates is a relaxation of the attachment to the idea of mutual vulnerability and the sort of precarious nature of deterrence relationships. And it all gets symbolized most sort of pointedly, I guess, in the end of 2001. You have the 9/11 attacks in September. So the US is kind of, again, psychologically reeling from this sort of shocking event. Mm. They're worried about sort of bolt from the blue attacks from non-state actors or so-called rogue states or whatever it is. And the Bush Jr. administration announces, we're not going to be in that treaty with the Russians anymore that limited our missile defenses. That was for a previous age. That was for a bygone era in which mutual vulnerability between the two superpowers was more important than anything else. It's not as important anymore. We need to be able to defend ourselves with missile defenses, and the technology has moved on as well. Actually, this all gets going really in the end of the Clinton administration. He kicks it into the long grass. Bush Jr. makes a decision. Yeah. And they unilaterally withdraw from the ABM treaty, which is the first time since the end of the Cold War that either side of that Cold War divide had pulled out of any of those Cold War treaties that had sort of kept the whole thing together.
Yeah.
And it's a key moment of it's the most, if you want, like your champagne top shelf second nuclear age moment, withdrawing from the ABM treaty is the one.
Yeah. It under discussed, underappreciated as like a kind of pivot point.
Yeah.
Okay, so the second nuclear age, it has more horizontal nuclear proliferation as a concern. And as a happening, I guess, on some level.
Yeah. I mean, India and Pakistan, you know, concerns about North Korea, which then come to fruition, concerns about Iran, obviously. Yeah. Yep.
And so in a certain respect, nukes are getting easier to get. Weaker states are getting a hold of nukes. The rogue actor problem becomes a thing in the imagination that proliferates. Underlying a lot of this is like a concern, or what justifies all this focus on proliferation and rogues and stuff, is that they're not going to do what we do as responsible actors, right? Like, they're not going to be responsible with their nukes like we would be, or they would do strategies that can't be deterred or something like that.
Absolutely, yeah. That was a key part of it, that these aren't necessarily deterrable actors. Yeah. So you old Cold War warriors who just want to talk about deterrence and mutual vulnerability, like, you're just not in the room anymore. You're not on the same page. These guys aren't deterrable.
Yeah. And you can see where that comes from, and you can see the basis for that. Like, it's not unfounded, but there's also some like color subtext to that that's like discomforting, or like should be questioned maybe. And to that end, you guys say in the piece, quote, "This is a periodization that of course makes more sense," talking about the ages, "that makes more sense from the perspective of an American or Western policy focused audience than it does from the perspective of the rest of the world." I agree with this. What are you saying there? You gestured at it with the whole rogue thing before, but.
Yeah. So I think there's two ways in which this makes sense primarily from a Western point of view, right? Mm-hmm. The first is that the kind of those who might see themselves as either contemporary or at least, you know, in the not too distant future, peer competitors, to use the contemporary phrase, the phrase we use a lot at the moment, yeah, of the United States. So those who fancy themselves as potential great powers, right? That basically say, you know, this whole idea that history has ended, thanks Frank, it's Frank Fukuyama for you, those of you playing along at home, you know, great power politics is over and all the rest. There's a couple of actors in there, namely Russia and China, who go, we'll see, right? And when the US says, okay, everything's changed, we're in a new nuclear age now, we need to think very differently, and we might actually deploy certain capabilities that we had all agreed that we wouldn't do in the past because that would be really destabilizing to that kind of central balance between the nuclear armed great powers, and the US is saying, well, this is all different now. Mm-hmm. We're going to deploy missile defenses, for example. because we need to defend against rogues and terrorists and all the rest.
Yeah.
The Chinese and the Russians just go, look, I'm really sorry, nah. Because what you're asking us to do is to trust you that you're never going to use these defenses to undermine deterrence with us and therefore give yourself the ability to have a first strike at our capabilities if we come into conflict with each other and not have to worry about our retaliation because you can soak it up with your whiz-bang missile defense shield. Yeah. Right? If the thing works as well as you say it's going to work, that's a problem for us in exactly the same way it was in the so-called first nuclear age. So in other words, from the Russian and Chinese point of view, they say, you can talk about a second nuclear age until you're blue in the face. The dynamics of what you now call the first nuclear age didn't disappear because you decided they have.
Yeah.
They're still right here.
Your defense makes you more offensive to us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the response from Washington never got any better than, trust us, we won't. And I know that sounds like I'm being kind of flippant and you must, listeners will probably think, well, come on, that must be unfair. They must have come up with more serious arguments. It's just they didn't. I've spent lots of time talking with people in the Pentagon, at Stratcom, across the US system about this and trying to say, but you get where they're coming from, right? And they're like, no, because the system will always be limited and aimed at rogues. So it won't be big enough to defend against everything that the Russians still have or everything the Chinese would have. So they don't need to worry about it. It'll only be a limited system that can only defend against your Irans, your North Koreas, and so forth. And when you say, okay, how can you guarantee that you're going to keep it limited? They say, oh, we will. Because we're the good guys, right?
Our nukes are good.
Our intentions are always good. So they're asking the Chinese and the Russians to trust them on a handshake and a wink. Yeah. And the Chinese and the Russians just kind of said, sorry, not good enough. Yeah. That's not how the world works. We're going to have to respond in kind. We have to make sure we have countermeasures to get over your missile defenses. And this is what's creating, this is where the argument gets, probably unnecessarily complex, but this is what's creating a third nuclear age. In other words, we say that it's the second nuclear age thinking, this decision that we're going to just perceive threats very differently and act accordingly. It's not just like it starts in the mind. It's a mental construct, periodization, right? It starts with you and I deciding that the world looks different. But what's important is it then changed our actions. And the action is, you withdraw from the ABM treaty and you deploy missile defenses. So before you know it, the second nuclear age, as it were, has been thought into existence. It's real now, right? Because you're now deploying technologies that you used to not deploy because you thought it was a bad idea to do so. And the response to that is what then creates a third nuclear age. We can kind of get to that, what that looks like. But that's the kind of the dilemma of second nuclear age thinking, right? That we decided everything was different. I should say, so that's the kind of great power element of this. That's the first reason why it really only makes sense from the West. If you said second nuclear age in London or DC or Canberra, people would sort of nod along and say, yep, know exactly what you mean. But if you said it in Moscow or Beijing, they'd look at you like you had two heads, right? Yeah. The other thing is that for the rest of the world, the nuclear age didn't change. Remember, the rest of the world have opted not to arm themselves with these weapons.
Yeah.
It's a tiny minority, right, that have these weapons, and the vast majority opt not to. From their point of view, that same division between nuclear haves and nuclear have-nots did not change. The numbers, crept up a little bit because India and Pakistan became overt about their previously covert systems where they were kind of arms racing against each other.
Mm-hmm.
So we added two more numbers. And then in 2006, the North Koreans, so we've got a third nuclear armed state. That's still a handful. The rest of the world, the entirety of the sub-Saharan African continent, the entirety of South America, in fact, the entirety of Latin America, we're like, we're all still nuclear unarmed. So this whole thing of, nuclear ages have changed and the dynamics have changed hasn't changed from our point of view. It's still, we're still as vulnerable as we were, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, I sort of mentioned this up at the very beginning of the episode, but just because we are talking about first, second, third nuclear age, we're talking about tendencies within the imaginations of a group of elite people that's sometimes transnational. So 100%. Basically a cadre of nuclear strategists and some nuclear scholars, they start thinking like this, focusing on this kind of problem set. They start obeying this kind of logic and trying to sell it to others. And so it becomes real in that sense. But for us to talk about it is not to validate it, but only to like recognize its embeddedness in reality as in their minds and shit. Like
exactly right. And so this was the hardest thing about writing that article, where we're like, we sort of tried to do it by talking about second nuclear age thinking and really emphasizing that. And we say explicitly that, you know, nuclear ages start in the mind.
Yeah.
But then they end up influencing policy and they have real world effects. And therefore the second nuclear age comes about whether we like it or not, but it's a choice. Agency is absolutely critical to this. And actually in the article, we argue, the title of the article is The Onset of a Third Nuclear Age, right? And we kind of say, look, we are on the verge of a third nuclear age, but we're really, really clear that if that happens, it'll because we've made decisions that create a third nuclear age. We do not have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Arms races don't just happen. Like, I'm not a pure structuralist, right? Like,
yeah.
I don't think that arms races, that states are forced into arms racing. It's always a choice. But to pretend that the choices we have don't affect others in that kind of structural sense is also disingenuous, right?
So it's a way of, it's like a subheading for a set of logics and incentives that people start making real. And so it's like a common way to refer to it. Yeah.
I mean, the sad thing is, I think we basically are now in the third nuclear age, the things that we point to, I think I'm seeing them play out. But yeah, we did want to kind of retain that idea that like, there is nothing inevitable about this. There is nothing natural about this. If it happens, we are creating it.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the difficulty of like trying to have a historical perspective or like a historical IR kind of take on things. Like when you retain that sensibility, it's hard to do that at the same time that you're developing like conceptual claims and branding and that kind of thing within the security study space.
And this happens, right? Oh, now you're the third nuclear age guys. And we're like,
I know. I mean, when I saw the title of the article, when it first came out, I was like, these fucking guys are selling a new donkey. Like, this is bullshit. Yeah, right. And then I read it. I was like, oh, okay, they get
it. Oh, no, actually, I see their point. Right. Yeah. And it's really tricky. And I think the position that Drew, this is my co-author on this and sort of co-conspirator on these matters, Andrew Futter, who's at the University of Leicester.
Yeah, he's very good.
Who's now running this great project that I'm involved with on the third nuclear age, right? Trying to understand the dynamics. And we're trying to give a global picture, trying to get out of that Western-centric mindset of what does the third nuclear age really look like all around the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's got this amazing team together doing really great work on this. But this is what we were really battling with, like that we see these dynamics at play. We want to be able to identify them and analyze them, not just for kind of scholarly analytical reasons, but for political reasons. If you just let this stuff just drift on through, it's, you know, it becomes policy and we make really bad policy decisions.
Yeah, no, I get it.
But equally, we're not promoting it. We're not saying, you know, that we ought to be thinking in third nuclear. Oh, I guess
this is because Paul Bracken, I mean, he wrote a book called The Second Nuclear Age, and he was selling it. Like he was persuading others about like, you need to buy into this. Yeah.
And Keith Payne and Colin Gray and a whole bunch. Yeah. It's kind of tricky. And that line between analyzing something and saying, hey, you guys are heading in this direction, that line, and then saying, you need to be understanding that you're heading in that direction, but we're not saying you have to. Like, that's quite difficult to do in practice, right? Like, you know, this stuff. It's
even this conversation is going to be like a little hard for people to like retain in their heads. These are the features, et cetera, et cetera. But then,
and on
like,
the one hand, we're saying it's not real, it's a mental construct. But on the other hand, it does have real world consequences. And like, it's kind of contradictory and whatever. And, you know, woe is us, poor old academics, right? Find some very small violins.
Okay. To that end, two related questions. What are strategic non-nuclear weapons, examples, of course? And then what is the third nuclear age? Because these two questions go together.
Yeah, cool. So in fact, I might almost do the second question first as a way into that, right?
Yeah,
so our argument is that the third nuclear age is, as I said, where it's coming from is old first nuclear age dynamics coming crashing into the policies that define the second nuclear age.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is that states are looking for new ways to try and regain parity and stability in those nuclear armed relationships, particularly at the great power level. And the way that they appear to be doing it currently, which is what's driving this third nuclear age and which is what gives the third nuclear age a genuinely unique characteristic. And I think it's unique enough so that we can say actually it makes sense to think of it as fundamentally different to the second nuclear age, is a reliance on what Drew and I are now calling strategic non-nuclear weapons. There's a whole bunch of terms that get used to describe the same thing. We're actually both guilty of it. We've used different phrases in the past and so
advanced
forth.
Advanced conventional weapons, precision-guided munitions.
So yeah. Advanced conventional weapons, often a lot of this gets wrapped up into emerging technology.
Yeah.
Or, the tricky thing with advanced, in fact, shout out to James Acton of Carnegie, who convinced me that strategic non-nuclear weapons, albeit not being a perfect phrase and it's a bit clunky, it's probably the most accurate
more
we've
precise,
got.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if you say an advanced conventional weapon, I mean, because a conventional weapon is a handgun all the way up to a tank,
yeah,
you'd say, well, the advanced version of that is the tank, obviously, right? So what we're talking about here is conventional capabilities, so they don't use a nuclear explosion, but that can be used to compromise an adversary's nuclear capabilities. So that's where they become strategic, mm-hmm. right? So it's a non-nuclear weapon that has a strategic impact. So what we're thinking about here is things like missile defense, but also offensive capabilities like anti-satellite capabilities, given that nuclear weapon systems rely for targeting and all sorts of things on satellite systems. So an anti-satellite capability, something that compromises a satellite, and that might be kinetically, can be the literally the missile that hits it, or it might be something that jams a satellite signal or even just points it in the wrong direction, right? A satellite that's pointing the other way is useless to you. Mm-hmm. So anti-satellite weaponry, anti-submarine warfare capabilities, so things that can compromise nuclear-armed subs, and offensive capabilities like precision-guided, precision strike missiles that are conventionally armed. So all the, if you'll pardon, awful pun, hypersonics. I was gonna, all the hype is about hypersonics, right? Like that is an example of a conventionally armed but strategic weapon, or a weapon that has a strategic impact. Mm-hmm. And then there's kind of supporting systems that people are really interested, right? They're not weapons themselves, but it's sort of software or supporting architecture. So things like AI, quantum computing, big data, all this sort of stuff. Cyber capabilities.
Cyber, I was going to say cyber, yeah.
Yeah, cyber is the other one, right? Now, what people often get wrong about this stuff is that they think it's all new, which is why calling them new and emerging technologies is a bit of a misnomer. Like missile defenses have been around as long as missiles. Mm-hmm. Anti-submarine capabilities have been around as long as submarines, right? Lots of this stuff isn't new, but it's only coming on board to have a strategic effect now because of developments in technology, that basically computing has become much better. Sensor technology has become much better than it was and so forth. It's becoming easier to find, not easy, it's always difficult, but easier to find and target an adversary's nuclear capabilities. And that, we think, is fundamentally new in the nuclear age at that strategic level. Mm-hmm. The other thing that people often get wrong about these weapon systems is they look at them on their own. So you can have, and I guarantee you, I have the scars to prove it, you can have unbelievably uninteresting debates about the efficacy of missile defense systems, where people just look at them on their own and say, well, look at the testing rate, you know, the best system in the world is only knocking down targets coming in 50% of the time, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, and definitely if you had to rely on a missile defense system on its own, I would be very nervous about using that system because it doesn't seem to work well enough to rely on. But of course you don't rely on it on its own. If you've knocked out the vast majority of your adversary's capabilities with an offensive strike, including precision-guided missile technology and hypersonics, anti-submarine capabilities, anti-satellite capabilities, cyber attacks, if you've done all of that, then the missile defense system only has to defend against whatever's left. And you know, they've only got 3 missiles left. I'll take my chances with the missile defense system. It looks pretty good, actually. The odds suddenly go right up.
It's not about what the technology can do. It's about what it can do in relation to a strategy.
Exactly. So we talk a bit in the article about the combinational logic of strategic non-nuclear.
That's a good way to put it.
And that makes them different from nukes. Nukes work kind of just on their own. Mm-hmm. You can amplify the effect of nukes using them in greater numbers or different types and so forth. But, you know, Harvard academic Graham Allison likes to say, you know, one nuclear weapon will ruin your afternoon, right? And so there's something to that with nukes. They're kind of the great equalizer thing. Strategic non-nuclear weapons don't work in the same way. Mm-hmm. But when you combine them, that's what makes a difference. And that's what we're seeing now. That's where we're seeing the development of strategic non-nuclear weapons across the board, across all of the either great or rising kind of would-be great powers, and they're all developing across all of the capabilities. No one yet has put all their eggs in the missile defense basket or the anti-satellite basket and said, look, all we really need is the best anti-satellite weapons in the world and that'll get us there. They're all hedging their bets and they're all developing across all the weapon systems. And that's now having effects in nuclear policy. So that's what we say, the third nuclear age is one in which strategic non-nuclear weapons become as or perhaps even more important in driving nuclear policies, in nuclear postures, in nuclear numbers, the willingness or otherwise to engage in nuclear arms control, all of these things. You can't just worry about nukes anymore. You've got to worry about these other annoying weapons, these strategic non-nuclear weapons.
That's right. It's like there are new incentives and arguments to double down and triple down on all of these different kinds of capabilities and then folding them into new strategies. And what we're left as like analysts of the system, we're left in the position of like trying to make sense of like how sensible is it to go down any or all of these paths? Like what are the risks and consequences and trade-offs and such and such? And unfortunately, a lot of people in our, they think they're in the business of advocacy on behalf of these things. And that's kind
exactly.
of. I would kind of like to, I guess I just gestured it, unpack the kinds of risks that are either being introduced or increasing as a result of strategic non-nuclear weapons becoming more prevalent. So like, what are some potential consequences?
So the first thing to note, I want to say this so that I'm not a complete, you know, Johnny Raincloud for the podcast listeners, that not all of these weapons technologies own, or these technologies more broadly, the supporting, you know, the AI stuff, quantum computing and all the rest, it doesn't only have destabilizing impacts. Some of these technologies can actually help restabilize relationships. The example I like is, and I'm not going to even pretend that I understand how the technology works, right? But I'm told, and the basic logic of this works, that advances in quantum computing can increase encryption. Mm-hmm. You can do clever things with quantum computing that makes sending signals, encrypted signals, easier and makes them sort of harder to hack, as it were. If that's the case, you can restore confidence in a state's ability to, for example, communicate with its nuclear armed submarines that are out there at sea. That's a great thing. Because submarines are, nuclear armed subs, are the kind of ultimate form of a survivable second strike or retaliatory capability because they're the hardest ones to find and compromise.
Yeah.
The oceans are big and it's easy to lose you know, your tail, those who are trying to find you out there in the oceans, right? So you, that's why states stick nuclear weapons on subs and say, get out to sea.
Yeah.
And so if advances in quantum computing help increase a state's confidence in the survivability of their nuclear armed submarines, that is a huge plus. That's, that can restabilize. If states are going to have nuclear weapons, and I don't want them to, right? Like I also, when I talk about deterrence, some people think that I'm advocating, therefore, that we should exist and live in a world, survive in a world just on deterrence postures only forever. Yeah. And I think that's unsustainable.
Yeah, yeah.
I think humans and machines make errors, right? We, our luck is going to run out at some point. The only smart move is to get to a nuclear disarmed world. It's unbelievably hard to do, but that's got to be the goal.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, on the way there, if states are going to continue to have nuclear weapons, I don't want them being nervous in a conflict.
Yeah.
I don't like jumpy nuclear armed great powers in conflict with each other. Right? So some of the weapons systems or supporting systems can actually be good. However, if we only focused on that, we would be being completely silly. And those who just want to do the kind of good news story that this is all a great development actually, and people are too negative about this stuff, are just a bit absurd. Most of the impacts of these weapons and their supporting systems currently are destabilizing. And it's mainly, as I said, in that combinational logic. It's the ability to find nuclear targets more easily and more accurately. Mm-hmm. It's the ability to hit them more accurately. And if you combine those two, that's really destabilizing, right? If all of a sudden I realize that you have a greater ability than I do to both find where my weapons are and that your forces that you would use to hit them are more accurate, so you're going to have a greater confidence that you can take out my stuff in a first strike and do it. The idea is no one's really concerned about this happening as a what we call a bolt out of the blue. No one thinks that whatever, the Russians are going to wake up on Tuesday or the Americans are going to wake up on Thursday and decide to strike another country's nuclear arsenal. Like, that's ridiculous and risky. However, in the middle of a shooting war in which your citizens are dying at, you know, in a naval warfare theater at sea, and the conflict is really escalating, and you're having discussions with your military advisor saying, gee, this could really escalate to the nuclear level, right? And they're saying, yeah, absolutely. We need to be really, really careful here. We're really worried that the other side are going to make a move. They've been moving their forces from here to there. They've been mating their warheads on missiles and things. They've been forward deploying bombers. We're really concerned they're going to come and hit us. And one of your advisors says, I tell you what, we also worked up this other plan where we think we can get all of their forces. And even if the bit of uncertainty that we have that we can't quite get all of them, you know, the 5% that are left over, we're really confident that our missile defense system can defend against that. What if we gave you this plan and you didn't have to be the first actor since 1945 to use nuclear weapons in doing so? You'd think really hard about it, right? Of course you would. In fact, you would not be doing your job as president or prime minister or whatever if you didn't, because you'd be saying, no, might be too risky. Let's just keep sending our young people off to die just in case that doesn't work out. Of course you'll think about it. You're not constrained by the nuclear taboo. You don't have to be that first president or prime minister or whatever to cross the nuclear threshold since 1945. But you could deny your adversary, who you're in a shooting war with, from having the ability to nuke you off the face of the planet by using strategic non-nuclear capabilities. You'd have to think very carefully about doing it. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the other side know that you would have to think very carefully about doing it. And so they start ensuring you don't get to that situation. They double the size of their nuclear capabilities so that you've got more targets to hit or whatever it is. And we're already seeing this play out. So last year there was the revelations about these new missile silos out in the desert in China. That's not a surprise to me. I know most people are kind of running around either completely freaked out or saying, aha, I told you they were evil and dastardly and they were planning this all along. I look at that and go, of course they are. It's literally what I would do if I was in Beijing. China has a relatively small nuclear arsenal, particularly compared to the US, particularly compared to what the US is developing. China too is developing these capabilities, right? Not the US on its own. There's no sort of bias or whatever in that regard, but it's just US power is real. It's a thing. Yeah,
China's obviously balancing. I mean, like, yeah, minimum deterrence or whatever, will. Like the minimum has, there's a new minimum. The minimum shifts depending on what's going
exactly
on.
Exactly.
Like,
and this is where this gets us back to that thing about in the first nuclear age, where did arms racing come from? Where's the minimum, right? What does parity look like? And so China kind of faces, as the US develops better sensing capabilities and better strike capabilities, it faces kind of there's a few things you can do. You can harden missile silos a bit more so they might be able to withstand a strike. But the two easiest ways, or two most straightforward ways, is you develop better submarines, quieter submarines that are harder to find, or you just develop more missile silos. You just have more targets. You give the US more targets to hit just to raise that question mark in their head. Could you definitely get all of them? Mm-hmm. And they are trying to develop quieter submarines, but that's really hard and really expensive. Do you know what's not these days? It's developing missiles. Do you know what's really not expensive? It's very inexpensive, is to just dig a missile silo that might have a missile in it. It doesn't even have to have a missile in it. You can do this thing called a shell game where you build 300 new silos and you only need 100 missiles and you move them around. So at the point when the US is considering striking, you've got to be 100% sure which missile is and which one's just an empty hole and which one has a missile in it, right? So that's actually the cheapest way of doing it. You just make yourself a harder target to hit. So we're already seeing strategic non-nuclear weapons driving nuclear decision-making, including the increase in arsenals. And it's no coincidence that China's increasing the size of its arsenal, Pakistan's increasing the size of its arsenal, because India's developing capabilities too. Even the Brits these days are talking about reversing this trend from it's been ongoing for a number of years. They're talking about actually increasing the size of their arsenal again because they're looking at what the Russians are developing.
Yeah.
So we're seeing this play out already. So it drives arms racing. The other thing is entanglement or commingling, putting these things together that your conventional or strategic non-nuclear capabilities often rely on the same, say, satellite systems as your nuclear capabilities. So the question becomes, if I knock out your satellites and I'm only doing it because I don't want you to use these conventional missiles and be able to target me, I've also compromised your nuclear missiles too. And what do you have
to... And if you're attacking our nuclear command and control, surely it's because you're about to launch a nuclear attack. So surely we got to go first, right?
Well, and you kind of hope that anyone who does that is going to have a better argument than that old US one we used to joke about on missile defense of like, no, trust us. You know, we weren't trying to compromise your nuclear capabilities, just the conventional ones. You know,
everyone needs better arguments than are currently on the table.
Then just trust us. We're the good guys, right?
Yeah.
Everyone thinks of themselves as the good guys. Come on.
That's the problem. Yeah.
So yeah, they're the kind of major things that we worry about in terms of stabilization, that it pushes arms racing, both in nuclear and conventional terms, and that it makes nuclear armed states in a crisis less rather than more confident in the survivability of their forces. And that can push you into that kind of user or user logic. That if we think you're coming anyway and you're going to take out all our forces, well, then waiting is suicide, right? We may as well launch it first and at least try and stop you in your tracks, even if we think you will then retaliate and it'll, you know, end up being a kind of a suicidal move. Well, waiting if you're coming to get me anyway is just as suicidal.
Yeah, I mean, you're increasing the risks of crisis instability when you're increasing the advantages that accrue to going first.
To moving first, exactly. And it's literally crisis instability 101.
Yeah, and that's literally what's happening, or that's the great risk of all of these new capabilities when they merge together, or they start to appear to policymakers as like the suite of toolkit that we're drawing on to decide what to do.
Yeah.
When they look at it as a totality, if they decide that this encourages them to go first or go early, to shift to the offense on some level, then that is by definition destabilizing. That's
a bad day, right?
And that's what we're supposed to be managing, you know?
Exactly. It's what we're meant to be trying to avoid, but we kind of got out of the habit of doing so.
Yeah.
Right? Why? Because we got, you know, into that whole second nuclear age malarkey and sort of thought of it in that term, to use a very colloquial Australian phrase. Apologies to non-Antipodean listeners, but look that one up. It'll be a fun little side project.
All right, gang, that's going to do it for part one. Part two is going to come up real soon, where we finish the conversation with Ben Zala. And I just wanted to mention real quick, too, if you want to support the pod, we're kind of done with Buy Me a Coffee, the newsletter that's officially undiplomatic.com, un-diplomatic.com. $5 a month paid subscription to that gets you all kinds of goodies, but it also backs a truly independent voice, which you know foreign policy needs. That's why you're listening. All right, peace.